Rabbi Murray Srego, Kirav Savunavuz, Prohibition, missed first few minutes.
And therefore, those religions, not only us, but many religions, use wine as part of their sacrament. So the assumption was that it would need to be protected in some way from whatever prohibition was written into law. And that that idea was indeed written into the law in what's called the Volstead Act. The Volstead Act was the law that was written in 1919 in order to regulate the 18th Amendment. And the Volstead Act very specifically says, this is Section 6 of the Volstead Act. Volstead is the name of a congressman who did most of the work on this. I have lots of copies of this. You can have a look.
Thank you.
So the Volstead Act says, nothing in this title shall be held to apply to the manufacture, sale, blah, blah, blah. But the important part is, here you go. No person to whom a permit, distribution of wine for sacramental purposes, that's the key point. The third line in there, that if you're using wine for sacramental purposes, and it's not referring to any other alcoholic beverages, only wine, and only for sacrament, then prohibition doesn't govern you. And not only that, but it says, a few lines down, to furnish any such person, not a rabbi, minister of gospel, priest, or officer duly authorized for the purpose by any church or congregation. Which means that it sets up a method by which sacramental wine is to be distributed to the various officers of religious denominations so that they can then give them to their congregants. So what is set up here by the Volstead Act, and it was actually written into the law in the Department of Treasury's regulations on prohibition, is the following. There needs to be, well, let's do the simple case. Let's say a Catholic church. Okay, a Catholic church uses wine as part of communion, right? On some daily or weekly basis, people come to the church and want to partake of the sacraments. They want to drink wine and eat the wafer. And in order to do that, they need wine. Okay, fine. So the wine is thereby provided with government authorization to the priest who runs that church, and he keeps it in the church, and he dispenses it to his congregants, under his supervision. Fine. That works very well if you're a Catholic church with a Catholic priest. Jews had a number of problems with the Volstead Act because, number one, most importantly, the large majority of the consumption of wine in Judaism does not occur in shul. It occurs at home, right? Kiddush, Havdalah, Dalet Kosot, and so on. That's number one. And therefore, it's inherently unregulatable. That's number one. Number two is, who is a rabbi? We don't have, in Judaism, a top-down hierarchy where, the pope ordains, his cardinals, and the cardinals bishops, and the bishops all the way down to your local priest. Particularly in America, people would walk off the boat at Ellis Island, claim that they were rabbis, claim that they had received smicha in some yeshiva in Europe, and practiced as rabbis with no certification, no legal status or anything, particularly in the 1920s. And therefore, who was a rabbi such that he could then obtain this sort of privilege from the government to then distribute kosher wine, or wine of sacramental use that the government would permit, was a big mess. Yeah?
Can you just comment, what was the background, why the amendment was created?
So that's a good question. Yeah, there are a few reasons for it, and it's important to point out. In fact, maybe this is the July 4th party. The United States is currently going through a nativist time, meaning that the election of Donald Trump in November was very much part of a nativist wave of good American people trying to take back our country from all these Mexicans and other people that Trump doesn't like, who are trying to take it over. And various nativist phases have come through over time. In the early 1900s, it was also a tremendous nativist phase. And people believed that good old American Puritan values include abstinence from liquor, or temperance at least, and that non-good, full, red-blooded Americans, people from, you know, Southern Europe, like Greece and Italy, or France, or other places where people are, and certainly from Eastern Europe, who were coming to the United States, were bringing in cultures that were not well aligned with this tradition, and therefore a big part of Prohibition was an effort to retake America, to make America great again, by getting alcohol off the streets. That's one big part of it. The second part of it was the increasing political power of women. Throughout American history, whenever women have risen in political power, so has an interest in stopping the consumption of alcohol. I don't know whether that's because women are often the objects of people who are drunk in terms of violence. I don't know whether it's because of sort of an evolutionary biology kind of thing, where women realize that drunken husbands are bad, you know, wage earners or whatever. But anyway, those two things come together in the first couple of decades of the 1900s to make this big push towards prohibition. So that's more or less what's behind it. And that's important for us because the extent to which Jews saw prohibition as a good or bad thing was very much relevant to the question of whether Jews felt themselves as being patriotic Americans or not. In the 1900s, or the early 1900s, the notion of Jews being, or that patriotic Americanism was important to Jews at all, was not at all a clear thing. Among more Americanized Jews, among Reform and Conservative Jews, at that time it was a foregone conclusion. Yes, of course, we should try and assimilate and be as American as possible. I don't mean assimilate in modern terms, as in stop being Jewish and stop being Shomer Mitzvot. I mean just to behave and dress and speak and attend schools like our non-Jewish friends. Whereas among the Orthodox Jews, most of whom were recent immigrants from Europe or the children of immigrants from Europe, they did not see being American as any big a deal, just as they did not see being Polish or Russian or wherever it is that they came from as being a big deal. They were Jews, and they did what Jews do, and they accommodate whatever this, you know, ambient society was. But it was not important to most Orthodox Jews to be seen as good patriotic, American citizens, except to the extent they didn't want to suffer anti-Semitism. That was really it. Yeah.
I am struck by minor detail here. In the middle of all that barter, exchange, furnish, any person not a rabbi, minister, blah, blah. Are you surprised that rabbis mentioned first?
Yeah, I am surprised.
I was also.
Yeah, there's some story behind that as well. I don't know who convinced the Ramaz to get on board with this early, but already when states started to pass prohibition measures, individual states, in the late 19-teens, the measure first passed the Senate in 1917, so 3 years before it ever took effect. The Ramaz and I don't remember who the other one was, some other representative of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, went down to Washington and managed to get the Department of the Treasury to write his name specifically in their regulations, saying that the person in charge of sacramental wine for Jews in the United States is going to be Rabbi Moshe Zebulun Margolios. And his opponent in this, within the Jewish community, was a guy named Louis Marshall. Louis Marshall was a Jew from upstate New York. He was from Syracuse or Utica or somewhere in there, who was a very well-respected lawyer, not personally observant at all, but very Jewish in culture and tradition. And he also then afterwards went to Washington and obtained from the Treasury an agreement that you didn't need to be an Orthodox rabbi in order to be a rabbi, and therefore the distribution of sacramental wine could be done by any recognized group of rabbis. And that, by the way, is why you had these competing rabbinic organizations that just sprang up in these years, in the 19-teens, in order to be the ones who would be, here you go, would be able to take advantage of the Volstead Act. The CCR, the Central Council of American Rabbis, which is the reform organization, starts in 1889, so that's a little earlier. But the Rabbinical Assembly, that's the conservative organization, Agudas Harabbanim, which I mentioned already, started in 1901 and 1902, so they were fairly new at this time. And Knesset Harabbanim, which is another Orthodox rabbinical group, started in 1920, specifically, presumably, for the purpose of competing with the Agudas Harabbanim for the right to distribute wine. And that was done and written into the Treasury regulations. All of these various organizations were authorized by the government as official distributors of sacramental wine to Jews. Anyway, okay. Because of
Knesset Harabbanim, what was unique about them?
That's also an interesting question. The Knesset Harabbanim differed from the Union of Orthodox Rabbis at that time in two really interesting ways. One was that the Union of Orthodox Rabbis was Zionist, and the Knesset Harabbanim was anti-Zionist. And number two, the Union of Orthodox Rabbis was pro-Yeshiva University, didn't call itself Yeshiva University then. It was just Yeshiva College and what's now MTA. Remember, MTA just celebrated its 100th anniversary, which is, therefore, you know, this is 2017, so that was 1917, so it's right at this time. Anyway, so those two things at that time were big differences between those two. Another big part of it was that the Knesset Harabbanim was composed almost entirely of rabbis who had been born in Europe. There were some American Orthodox rabbis who were members of the union of the Agudas Harabbanim, but much fewer. Much fewer. Anyway, okay. So these two factors, number one, the fact that Jewish wine is being consumed at home, and number two, that it's very hard to figure out who a Jewish rabbi is, both led to tons of corruption. Tons of corruption. Because you'd have the following situation. You'd have, number one, people who had no particular Jewish affiliation or interest until now, all of a sudden are joining shuls in order to obtain, I mean, you had shuls with memberships of 100 that rose to 1,000 in 1 year in order to obtain these sacramental wine privileges. And by the way, people would join shuls with names, you know, the membership included people with names like, you know, O'Flannery and Mulligan, that kind of stuff. So clearly that was the purpose. And number two is that rabbis were making money on this. Because rabbis were the ones who were providing these sacramental wine permits to their congregants so they could charge for that, you know, service, just like rabbis charge for selling chametz. So, or any other services that they perform. So there was a tremendous interest in rabbis getting involved in this business in order to make money. And also remember at that time, Jews mostly, certainly the ones that had come from Eastern Europe, were poor. And therefore rabbis were not well paid or supported by their communities and needed to find sources of income other than just being the rabbi of a shul or a school. And so this was a tremendous opportunity. For example, it is said, I haven't proven this, but it is said that the Ramaz himself was getting 25 cents per bottle of wine sold in New York City for some of this, which is a tremendous amount of money. Okay, so that corruption...
I'm blurring something here, though. I can't picture somebody named O'Leary joining a shul to get Manischewitz Concord. Great. You're kind of blurring here Jewish wine, wine in general... and hard liquor.
So,
can you?
I thank God I have never been alcoholic. But from what I understand, people who are will
drink
feed their habits with whatever they can get their hands on.
But you're saying that's what's going on here?
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Manischewitz must have exploded.
There are the Seagram's Company, for example, is a really good example. Seagram's is in Canada. Seagram's was moving sacramental wine across the border in huge quantities throughout Prohibition.
Also, it was Don Vito.
Yeah. Anyway, so to give you an example of the corruptions going on, so flip to the second side of the page.
I had a question
with the
time.
Sorry.
What's the mechanism? How did it actually work, the sale, etc.? That seems to be important.
So the rabbis weren't allowed to be in the business of selling wine themselves. What was supposed to happen was there would be some company that would either import wine from overseas or make it in Napa Valley in California or wherever, and offer it for sale, but they were only allowed to offer it for sale as sacrament, and it was the rabbi's job to provide the heksher and to say, okay, this guy walking through the door, he is permitted. You're allowed to have 10 gallons of wine per year. And the rabbis would hand out coupons that said, you know, here's my 10 gallons, you know, that the rabbi has given me permission to buy, and so on. So the rabbis would charge for the coupon, not for the wine. Okay, anyway, so you have here in note 19 here, the New York Times in March of 1921, and this was not the only one. There were 5 or 6 of these just that I saw, and I'm sure there were many more, as well as many articles that appeared in other newspapers, not just New York Times, about corruption being discovered in the sacramental wine business. Here you have where a place, if you look at the bottom of the box there, there is a place called the Menorah Wine Company operating on the Lower East Side in 110 Bowery, which had $250,000, which is a tremendous amount of money at that time, worth of wine that was seized because it was proven that they were selling it not to people who were using it for sacrament, but the speakeasies. And the main U.S. government agent who was working on behalf of the government in busting Jewish companies was this guy in the picture over here named Izzy Einstein. Izzy Einstein, the one in the white hat, his friend Mo Smith is the one in the gray hat, is one of the more colorful characters of Prohibition, which itself was a very colorful time. Einstein, as soon as he saw Prohibition going into effect, he wanted money for it, but he went unsolicited to the Department of the Treasury offering his services. They told him, you don't look like an IRS agent. In those days, Treasury agents were expected to be in good physical condition and so on. He says, listen, I'm Jewish, I look Jewish, I can walk among Jews, I speak Yiddish, I'm personally observant, I'll be able to infiltrate and to get involved. And indeed he did, and many, many, many times. And his name is quoted in the New York Times frequently.
He was from? Observant.
Let's put it this way. He would not eat non-kosher food in public. That for sure we know. The reason why we know that is because he once walked into a speakeasy and he suspected that it was him. And in order to find out whether it was Izzy Einstein or not, they served him a ham sandwich and he only pretended to eat.
So he was really voluntary to the series.
Well, you could argue that, or you could say that he was trying to keep the Jews on. I don't know.
I heard he actually ate it, but he pretended to enjoy it.
How do you pretend to eat it?
Okay, I don't know. I don't know. If you go someplace for Shabbos lunch and you don't like what they serve, you have to learn that skill. That's an important one. Anyway, okay, so there was corruption. The corruption is written up in the New York Times through the first half of the 1920s. Repeatedly, it is the case. And Jews in official capacities throughout the United States are becoming increasingly upset about it. First of all, because it's always a Chilul Hashem when there's corruption among the Jews. Second of all, because it feeds the anti-Semitic sentiment that was part of the nativism that's behind the whole thing to begin with. And so an effort begins to generate to do something about it. What are we going to do in order to stop this corruption that's happening? So in note 3 here, you have an article that was written in a Yiddish newspaper called Das Yiddische Licht in 1923 by a guy by the name of Shlaga Feivel Mendelitz. Now, before this, I didn't know anything about Shlaga Feivel Mendelitz. Everything I know about him now, I like. Most importantly is the following. When I first started teaching in MTA, Rabbi Talvis was the principal of MTA, and he wanted to call me Rabbi Srego, because I have earned that title. And I didn't want to be. I wanted to be Mr. Srego because my job had nothing to do with being a rabbi. I'm a college guidance counselor there. I teach U.S. history. And so I didn't think being rabbi was helpful to my job, and I actually thought it was, in certain cases, a detriment. So I wanted to be Mr. Srego, and he took a while to get used to that idea, but eventually he gave in. And I discovered that this Rabbi Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, even though he tremendous accomplishments in his life, he's the father of Torah Umasora, he's the father of Yeshivas Torah Vadas, and of Chaim Berlin, and Lakewood Yeshiva, and Camp, which is now called Camp Neir Shraga, or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, a tremendous amount of things he accomplished in the United States. He, even though he had smicha, was always Mr. Mendelowitz. So I have great affection for him. Anyway, so he writes here in this Yiddish newspaper about how upset he is about the rabbinic behavior during Prohibition. Read a few lines from it here. One need only to consider the wine business, which many rabbis are heavily engaged in. How much shame, how much degradation, how much desecration of the honor of the Torah lies therein. This is, of course, translated from the Yiddish. Rabbis who ought to be the ones to ensure that the laws of the land are upheld are instead the direct or indirect cause of their violation. And then he goes on to say, and if you think about it halachically, all of this is for the purpose of Kiddush. Kiddush is at best only a mitzvah derabanan, right? Because Kiddush on wine is only derabanan d'oraisa. You fulfill Kiddush by saying, you know, Mekadesh and Shabbos and Shmones, right? And therefore, how can you say that the performance of a mitzvah derabanan should be permissible in a way that causes all this chol Hashem? And not only that, he says, but you could use raisin wine. You could use wine that was made in a way that would not violate the rules of prohibition and solve the problem altogether.
Why is raisin wine not subject to prohibition?
Because it wasn't alcoholic.
The law's made.
Raisin wine is grape juice.
It wasn't real wine. Gotcha.
Okay.
I want to point out that raisin wine was what was commonly used anyway by Eastern European Jews. Before they came here, raisin wine was the most common kind of wine. People
that's interesting.
People would make it at home.
Okay, so that's actually going to be important. I didn't know that.
What about using challah?
So that's a good question. It is true that you can, on Friday night at least, make kiddush on challah and thereby
biyotze,
but it's not preferred. It's certainly not preferred. It's done generally by people who can't get wine. Or can't get grape juice. Now, he was forced to retract this. In the next issue of Das Yiddische Licht, Mr. Mendelowitz publishes a retraction in which he says, I made a mistake. The things that I'm accusing rabbis of doing, really rabbis are not doing. Rabbis are all great and wonderful and honorable. It's people pretending to be rabbis who are actually the source of the problem here. But it's clear that this was his true intent, the first thing that he writes here. But his point, namely, that you can be Jewish and you can do all the mitzvahs without being required to have an exemption to the laws of prohibition, was a very popular idea among many Jews, because Jews were feeling that all that was happening through the sacramental wine privilege was pointing the finger at Jews as being non-American. Because the whole point of prohibition, like I mentioned before, is to distance oneself from intoxicating liquors because of the bad effect. And even though throughout the centuries, Jews have been far less guilty of drunkenness than have the population of whoever we lived with, nonetheless, when you're in a time where there's no gray at all, where it's either white or black, everybody claims at least to be interested in temperance. So then, for the Jews to have an exemption from that law sets us apart and implies that we are something other than good old red-blooded Americans. And therefore, there was a lot of interest, particularly among the Reform and Conservative movements, to get rid of this wine privilege, to tell government we didn't want it altogether, we would suffice with raisin wine or grape juice or whatever. Yeah.
Grape juice was commercially available at this point?
Yes. The Welch's Grape Juice Company actually starts in the late 1800s, a guy named Welch. by people who are interested in temperance. That's also a point which needs to be understood, but I'll get to it a little later.
And Mr. Mendelowitz didn't back off from the halakhic assertions in this article.
No, he did not. That's correct. No, he did not. Okay, so the conservative movement comes to Louis Ginsburg. As I mentioned before, Louis Ginsburg is the chairman of the Talmud department at JTS, and asks him for a tshuva on the matter. He wrote a tshuva which was very, very long, also in 1923, in Hebrew. The English translation, I haven't seen the Hebrew version of it. The English translation of it appears in the American Jewish Yearbook from that year. It's a very long tshuva, even in English, although the English is only a summary of it. My notes here from, let's say, 4 through 13, or 12 at least, are basically the essence of that tshuva, which I want to go through. And then I'll give you some commentary on it. So the question that he starts off and says the following. He says, listen, my goal here is to encourage people to use grape juice for Kiddush. He says right off the bat. He says, this is an agenda-driven tshuva. That's number one. Number two is that I recognize in order to do that, I can't just prove that grape juice takes Barit Priya Gafen. I can't just prove that grape juice is acceptable for Kiddush. I have to prove that grape juice is the equivalent of wine for Kiddush. It's no less preferable from a halachic point of view, because absent that, anybody who wants to do the mitzvah mina mufchar is going to still demand wine, and I can't stop them. So therefore, he says, my point in this tshuva is going to be to demonstrate that indeed there is no mitzvah mina mufchar to use wine over grape juice. Grape juice is equally acceptable. So he starts with the Gemara in Bava Basra. Bava Basra says, Amar Rav Zutra bar Tuvia Amar Rav. That in order to make kiddush, you need to use a liquid which is also kosher for use as nisuch hayayin in the temple. Now, the Torah, Tanakh, does not talk about wine for sacramental purposes, except in this regard. So therefore, it would certainly make sense to say that if I want to use the wine that Tanakh considers to be wine, this would be the category that I would want to fit. So, okay, fine. So the Gemara says, "Lutemah." So what then is the sort of liquid that would not fulfill that requirement and thereby be unacceptable for Kiddush? So, if you'll suggest that the purpose of this halacha is to exclude wine from the vat, what does it mean, wine from the vat? It means freshly squeezed wine. Wine which is in the production processes, it has not fermented yet, it's freshly squeezed, it's grape juice. Yain migito is the Gemara's discussion of grape juice. So if you'll say that that's what we should not be making kiddush on, the ha tani Rabbi Chia said, yain migito levi, it is true that lichachila one should not use grape juice for nisuch hayayin, but the ime vikasher. But if you do use grape juice for nisuch hayayin, it's fine. Bidyevet, the kevan di may be kasher, and therefore, if bidyevet, it's sufficient for nisuch hayayin. So anan, we afilu chachila nami. We can use grape juice lechachila for kiddush. The amar Rava, because Rava said, sochet adam eshkol shalavim. A person can squeeze out a cluster of grapes. Ve'omer alav kiddush hayom, and make kiddush on the product. Yeah.
Two problems. One, you're assuming, I think, Yain Bigito is non-alcoholic. You're calling it grape juice.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes. Nobody denies that. The only question about the difference between what we have in a bottle of, you know, Kerem grape juice and what they had physically squeezing out grapes is that, and I'm not going to deal with this in this year, but if you do more research on it, that you'll find that the post can talk about it, is that grape juice, when it's first squeezed out of a grape, if you just leave it for a while, it will ferment, and it will become wine. Okay, it will become alcoholic. Whereas you could leave a bottle of Welch's or you know Manischewitz or whatever grape juice forever, and it will not ferment because it has had chemicals, sodium bisulfate and others, put into it that kill the fermenting agents, kill the yeast that's in the grape. And therefore, it won't ever become grape juice. And some posts can want to claim that there is reason why that should affect us halachically. But in terms of what Yayin Mihito is, if you would drink it at that time, it's indistinguishable from regular.
And the phrase "v'kevin deim hevi kosher," I don't know if you chachila nami. Doesn't that sound? It was kind of.
No, because if you apply a standard of either is or is not kosher as nisuch hayayin, and if it is, we don't care whether it's lichachila or b'dieved for the mizbeach, then that makes it a kosher liquid upon which.
So whatever the continuation of the Gemara is. It's just taking a phrase, v'im hevi kosher, which I think
that refers
in
to
a vacuum you would say as, that's certainly b'dieved.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And here it's just saying, never mind.
No. It's b'dieved for the mizbeach. It's l'chatchila for kiddush.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Excuse me, so it is understood that this wine was kosher wine in 1917?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Correct. And the Rashbam, that Gemara in Baba Basra makes a point which I think is important. He says, "Ein Omer Kiddush Hayom Uvayin Haraui Lavarecha Lavarecha Gafen Kamer." Obviously, we're talking about wine on which you have to say the bracha Lavarecha Gafen. The Af Algad Marchina Lavarecha Gafen LeKiddush Hayom Miha Lochashi. And that this Gemara is pointing out that unless it fits the standard of being Ovel Gavim Zbeach, then, even though you say Borei Pirei Gafen on it, that's not good enough. But obviously, the Rashbam is pointing out, you can't consider for Kiddush some liquid upon which you wouldn't even make Borei Pirei Gafen. So, when we'll get to this a little bit later, if you would suggest that you don't make Borei Pirei Gafen on the grape juice that we have, for whatever reason you choose, then obviously it would not be acceptable as wine. As liquid for Kiddush. Okay. Now, Rabbi Ginsburg goes on to quote the Behag. Behag in Hilchos Kiddush and Avdalah, this is note 6, says, "Ilet lecham," if a person does not have wine, and that's an important prefix, then maiti inve, you should get some grapes, ve'atzar lahadan, and you should squeeze them. Now, he makes an important point. This is one of these don't try this at home things. Because the Gemara had said, right, so chet adam eshkolanim, squeeze grapes and make kiddush hayom on it. So the Behag says, wait, be careful about this. B'ma'ale Shabbat.
Right,
yeah. Squeeze the grapes on Friday. Right? You can't squeeze grapes on Shabbos because that's one of the malachim. U'ma'ale yom ataba, or on erev yom tov. U'le urta, and then at night, mekadesh aleha. Okay, you can't squeeze the grapes on Shabbos. De Amar Rabbah, and then he quotes the Gemara that we just saw. Sochei Adam Ashkol Shlan Avim VeOmer Alav Kiddush Hayom, and he adds an important point here: Ho Iyo VeGabi Nazir Karu Yain. Because after all, with regard to Hilchot Nazir, right? The Nazir is not allowed to have various grape products. The Torah says Michar Tzani Matzah. Great, you can't have seeds, you can't have the peel. The pasuk does not say anything about grape juice. And the Gemara, with regard to Nazir, equates them all. All things that come out of grapes are equally considered wine with regard to the halacha of Nazir. So the Behag is pointing out here, clearly, if it's considered wine, grape juice is considered wine with regard to Nazir, there's no reason why it wouldn't also be with regard to Kiddush. And in fact...
Is that Rashbam at odds with the way you explain for to me, Gemara?
Why?
Well, if I'm understanding it right, what you said was the Gemara's conclusion is, even though the Lashon is only b'dieved, that's from his bath, but l'chachila, it's okay for Kiddush.
Right.
And then the Rashbam says, mi'a lo chashiv. Oh, Kiddush, that's Kiddush, you're on. No. Well, is lo chashiv on the Kiddush Rabba or on the Ayin?
Why did I put this in here? One second, I don't remember. Oh, the point is that he's commenting on the first part. When the Gemara is saying, what limutei mai, what is it that we want to exclude, right? So the Rashbam is saying, because you should be aware of the fact that we're not talking about excluding orange juice and lemon juice and tomato juice. Those obviously you can't make kiddush on, because those aren't Borei Pirei Gafen. We're asking a separate question. We're saying, once already you've got a liquid upon which you do make Borei Pirei Gafen, nonetheless, perhaps we shouldn't use it for kiddush, because it's not allowed on this man.
So he is. So then he is ignoring, not ignoring, but he is at odds with the way we're reading the Gemara.
No. The Gemara's answer is grape juice cannot be the liquid that Gemara is trying to exclude. The Gemara goes on, it has a whole list of liquids. One of them, this is why I only put it here, grape juice. For example, yain mevushal is one of the things that the Gemara discusses. Because mevushal, you can't bring on lav mizbeach. Or maybe not. Anyway, that's that. Shulchan Aruch codes what the Rashbam and what the Gemara says. Yain miki tomek hadashin alav sochet adar eshkol shalom avim eomer alav kiddush hayom. So the Shulchan Aruch, and this is Rabbi Ginsburg's point, is clearly stating that there's no difference between the two for the purpose of Kiddush. Yes, you can use grape juice. Mm-hmm. However, the Magen Avraham limits that heter. He writes, number 8 here, Yain migito umikol makom mitzvah b'yayin yashan kemash shekatavti siman tafresh. He says, that is not completely true. It is still preferable to use old wine. Old wine here doesn't mean old as in it's been sitting in a vat for a long time. It means as opposed to grape juice. It means fermented wine. Now, that's a big problem, and Ginsburg acknowledges it. He says, in order for me to convince you that you can drink grape juice indiscriminately without any preference for wine, I need to prove to you that the Magen Avraham is wrong, and this is what he says. He says, the Magen Avraham bases himself on a Maharil, which I have here in note 11, which I'll get to in a minute. And he thinks that he never saw the Maharil or misread the Maharil, which we'll get to in a minute. Now, point one. Why is the Magen Avraham sending you to Siman Tafresh? What's Siman Tafresh? So look at note 9. Note 9 is talking about Siman Tafresh, Shulchan Aruch Arachayim, is Bekiddush Leil Sheni. We're talking about the second night of Rosh Hashanah. On the second night of Rosh Hashanah, you've got a problem. The problem is Shehechiyan, right? We have a problem as to whether Rosh Hashanah is actually one day or 2 days halachically. If it's only one day, then on the second night you shouldn't be saying the Shehechiyan because it's nothing new. Therefore, we have a minhag that when you say Kiddush on the second night of Rosh Hashanah, you should do something to reinforce your Shehechiyan. So the Shulchan Aruch says, "Bekiddush Leil Sheni," when you're saying Shehechiyan, "Yilbash Beged Chadash," you should have a new cloak on you. "Oh Meniach Pri Chadash," or have a new fruit on the table, and then "Veomer Shehechiyan" in order to back up the Shehechiyan and Kiddush. Fine. On that, Shulchan Aruch says the Magen Avraham there, "Im yesh lo tirosh," if you are tirosh chadash, if you have new grape juice, I'll explain to you a second why he writes that. "Yikadesh al hayayin yashan," you should first make kiddush on the wine. In other words, the first kiddush begins borei pri hagafen, right, and then asher kiddush adam, and so on, asher bachar bar mikolam, right. So then, first make Kiddush on your old wine, ukishia gila shehechianu, and then at the very end of Kiddush, when you get to the shehechianu, then ye tol hatirosh biado, then put down the cup of your nice wine, pick up the cup of grape juice, the af al gav de mekanshin al tirosh, obviously, even though you could have made the entire Kiddush on grape juice, kimash katav and so on, at the what we saw earlier, nonetheless, mikol makom yashan mitzvah min hamukhar, nonetheless, it's better to make the Kiddush on the wine and to only use the grape juice as your backup for Shehechiyan. Okay, now, first point. Why are we talking about this in Rosh Hashanah? So two reasons. First of all, we have the problem of Shehechiyan and Rosh Hashanah. We don't have it on other holidays. But more importantly, grape juice at that time did not exist except in the early fall. The reason is because they did not have preservatives. So therefore, if you had any fruit juice, the fruit juice is either going to do one or two things. Either you can get it to ferment and turn it into something that will self-preserve because of the alcohol, or it's going to go bad. And therefore, in the only time that you could have fresh grape juice or orange juice or anything was at the season when the grapes are growing. Well, the grapes grow in the summertime. You pick them at the end of the summer, squeeze them, and then you have fresh grape juice in September, which is when Rosh Hashanah comes out. So that's why, for example, that you don't have anything in the halacha in early times about grape juice for dal kosot, because there was no grape juice in April. It didn't exist.
You're saying you can squeeze it on the second night?
No, you'd have to squeeze it the day before Rosh Hashanah.
So it's going to be fermented?
No, for one day it'll last. Yeah, for
how
one day
long does it take to ferment?
Approximately 40 days. Actually, this is a point which I'll quickly make. Imagine if you're a Napa Valley wine merchant or grower in 1918 or 1919, and you see prohibition coming, it's going to obviously destroy your business. So one of the things that the California people did in order to solve this problem was they sold something called wine bricks. A wine brick was grape juice that was dehydrated, thank you. They took all the water out of it, and they solidified it into a brick, and they wrapped it in this paper label with instructions of how to use this without violating the laws of prohibition. So I said, don't let this sit in water for more than 40 days. Don't let it sit in a place, you know, that will cause it to ferment because it couldn't find it. Anyway, so yes. Now, the Magen Avraham is arguing here that there's a mitzvah min ha-muvchar for wine, and therefore, if you have both wine and grape juice, you should prefer to make kiddush on wine. And in even in an occasion where grape juice is useful to you, because you need it for the shachianu, you still should make kiddush on it. You should still prefer the old wine.
What do you mean?
He wants you to put down your first cup upon which you made the bracha for kiddush, pick up a second cup, which is your bracha for a cup of grape juice, and on that to say the shachianu in kiddush on second day Rosh Hashanah.
Yes.
Is it even halachically permissible to pass over a fermented cup of wine and say shachianu on the grape juice? I mean, it just seems much less.
The wine you had last Shabbos, you know, that's not new. You can't say shachianu. Shachianu is really on the yom, right?
Right.
So as backup, because we're worried about the fact that shachianu really isn't appropriate for the yom because it's still yesterday. Therefore, you need something new upon which you can say the bracha.
Find shachianu and grape juice of kiddush.
That's what I'm saying. It just doesn't strike me as something.
It was new at that time because it's the end of the summer. It's the first time you had grape juice all year.
Shachianu and orange juice.
If it's the first time you've had
it. Doesn't that imply that it's something that is not wine? The fact that you're making a shachianu on it?
No, no.
Why? Just because you make a shachianu on a new suit doesn't mean you never had one before.
You're not drinking the soup.
Anyway, all right, so where do you get this from? So the Maharil, is presumably the source for the Magen Avraham. Maharil says basically the same thing. Zman shemivartin b'leil sheni de Rosh Hashanah, the brach of Zman, which is shechianu, that you make on the second night, yesh poskim. There are those who say, you should make all the rest of kiddush on regular wine. Grape juice cannot be motzi the bracha for wine. Says, and this Rabbi Ginsburg claims is the reason why he thinks that the Magen Avraham never actually saw the Maharil. Because the Maharil here is not talking about a question of what's preferable to use for kiddush. He's talking about what is the bracha. In other words, when you make kiddush, let's say, for example, Shabbos morning and shul, we have a kiddush after davening. Sometimes. So at that kiddush, right, Rabbi Adler makes kiddush on wine, everybody who wants to makes their own kiddush on their own wine or grape juice, and then they go and eat. Well, one of the things that's available at the kiddush is a cup of soda. So a cup of soda, should you or should you not say a bracha of shehakol after you've had the kiddush on the wine? So generally we say that a bracha that you make on wine at the beginning of a meal is poter all of the drinks that you have during that meal. We don't usually think about it because normally when we sit down to a meal, we start with hamotzi. Hamotzi is poter everything. But the question is that true only with regard to wine, or is it also true with regard to grape juice? And in fact, the Maharil here is saying that it is not true with regard to grape juice. That grape juice, if you make kiddush on grape juice at the beginning of your meal, does not poter your obligation to make another bracha on wine, which you would have later in the meal. And he quotes a Yerushalmi here. Kidavina b'Yerushalmi, balo yayin yashan b'toch ha-suda. If you have wine that comes to you in the middle of the meal, yivareh shenit, Afal pishik farbi rechal achadash. Even though you already made a bracha bari pri agafen on grape juice, nonetheless, when you get wine, that wine requires a new bracha. V'keva diayin ha'eshan kover bracha la'atzmo chashuvu mukdam l'kiddush. And therefore, since wine has this higher status than does grape juice, therefore, it makes sense to use it for kiddush to impote everything that comes later on. Now,
could that be possibly referred to those on negative?
No. For sure not. And I'll prove it to you. Look at the Rush. The Rush is the source of the Ma'aril. The Ma'aril and the Rush were contemporaries. The Rush is about 40 years older than him. This is early 1300s. The Rush writes, Im Shata, and he's commenting on the Yerushalmi here. Yerushalmi is hard to understand. Yerushalmi, the text of which is unclear. I don't want to waste time on it, but look at the Rush. Rush is very good. Im Shata Yain Chadash Tchila. If you drink grape juice, the Acharkach Yain Yashan, and then afterwards you get old wine, fermented wine. Sarich lemarech barei pregaf and al hayashan v'lo miftar barei pregaf and shibrei hachadash. The chashuv kimin acher, because it's as though it were a different object. Legabe chadash, as opposed to the grape juice. Lefi di ishtane tvei leiluya, because it has changed in a improved manner. So what's the Rush referring to when he says ishtane leiluya? So he's referring to a Gemara and Brachos. Gemara and Brachos asks a very simple question. The general rule the Mishnah says is that on any juice, tomato juice, lemon juice, orange juice, you say shakol. Except two things. Except olive oil and wine. Those two, olive oil gets a bracha of Bori Priya Eitz, and wine has its own special bracha, Bori Priya Gav. Why is that, says the Gemara? Why is that? Maishna Yain. What is different about wine that exempts it from the rule that it should be shakol? So ilema mishum deishtani li'iluya, if it's only because wine has improved, that's the same language that the Rush used, ishtani lebracha, should that also therefore change its bracha? So we know that that can't be. I skipped a piece of the Gemara here. The Gemara says, well, that can't be true because olive oil also is an improvement over olives, and nonetheless it doesn't get its own special bracha, it's just a regular ha'etz. So the answer is chamer it beitarte. Wine has two factors. Number one, sa'id, it fills you. And number two, misameach, which obviously means it's intoxicating, and therefore it makes you happy. All right, so the point here that Rabbi Ginsburg finishes with is the following. The Magen Avraham misread or never saw the Ma'aril. His presumption that there's a preference for grape juice over wine is incorrect. The only time where you should be careful to use wine for kiddush is if you happen to have both wine and kiddush, a wine and grape juice, and you intend to drink both wine and grape juice. Then you should say your bari pri agafen on wine for technical reasons, because of one being poter the birkat haneni for the other. But there's no preference, claims Rabbi Ginsburg, at all for wine over grape juice for kiddush. That's point one. Now, this happens in 1921 or 22, maybe 23, I don't remember. There is silence from the Orthodox rabbinate in response to this. Louis Marshall, mentioned to you before, the head of some American Jewish conference, I don't remember, American Jewish Congress, I don't remember, repeatedly wrote letters to the Ramaz and to other Orthodox rabbis to try and get them to sign on to this tshuva. Not only did they say no, they didn't say anything. No response at all to Louis Marshall. It's not known exactly why. That was one of the questions I had for Rabbi Lookstein, but I don't have an answer yet. Years later, in 1927, there appears a commentary on the Sefer HaChinuch written by a guy by the name of Rabbi Isaac Simcha Horowitz. Rabbi Horowitz was a rabbi in Hartford, Connecticut, Orthodox rabbi. And he publishes this book called the Yad HaLevi, which is his commentary. He was a Levi himself. He comments on the Sefer HaMitzvos. And in the mitzvah of Zachoras Yom HaShabbos L'Kadosho, he has the following, which I'm just lazy. I don't like to type in Hebrew, so I translated it for my own convenience. He writes, Shira can only be said on wine. Why? As he quotes the Gemara Brachos, because it's both satisfying and intoxicating. Therefore, he says, if the power to arouse, in other words, the alcohol that's in the wine is removed, such as in our grape juice, which is pasteurized before it begins to ferment, it loses its specialness and becomes even less than fruit juice, because they, at least, have a small alcoholic content. It becomes like orange juice or lemon juice, which is added to seltzer, he says, as a flavoring, and therefore it's shehakol. So his contention is that non-alcoholic grape juice should carry a bracha of shehakol. That's point one. Point two, he says, he attacks Rabbi Ginsburg. He says, and this drink, which lacks both taste and the smell of wine, is the subject of the Gaon HaKaraim. Gaon HaKaraim. Now, we all know the Karaim are people who deny the validity of Torah Shabbat Peh, which was the claim that was being made against conservative Judaism at that time. But he does something even cleverer than that. Karaim is spelled with an aleph. He spells Karaim with an ayin, as in the one who tears away. And therefore, he's implying that this is a group, that he writes out, in case you didn't get the pun, this is a group that seeks to tear away from the Jewish community. He has permitted it for Kiddush and Havdalah. And this pamphlet, which he has brought to darkness, is a translation of Yetzalah Choshech. Right, exactly, very good. But normally when you publish something, it's described in Hebrew as Yetzalah Or, so he's inverting the words there to imply that it's terrible. He has employed reasoning as weak as the drink he has tried to permit, claiming that it is only to permit it for mitzvah, but that is even preferable. Okay, so he attacks Ginsburg on a number of levels. And at the same time, he writes a sha'ila to the Har Tzvi, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, who's living in Israel. Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank publishes it here. You see Cheshvan of Tav Resh Pei Zayin, which is 1927. And here's one little point here that I'm very proud of myself about. If you look this up in places like the Bar Ilan, source book. So it mistypes the Har Tzvi here. He writes, I'm writing, this is the third line here, Arich Bedin Ha Grape Use. So they have it there as Grape Yom. It's clearly not Grape Yom, it's Grape Use. Hu Mitz Anavim, which is grape juice, Shetekeh L'Shchitat Hanavim V'Bashlimoto, that they pasteurize it immediately upon squeezing it out of the grapes. The ayah said, if kai menu kocha alcohol, and therefore it doesn't have any alcoholic content. The atzala reeve al zesha amar ki mitzvah mina mufra la kadesh ala grape use. And he, Rabbi Horowitz, is fighting against Rabbi Ginsburg, who said that you can use this for kiddush. The halasha halacha de mevarchen ala bor priya gafen. And he also says that you shouldn't even be making bor priya gafen and grape juice. The chayin ein mekadshin lavet garuah mishar mei pirot. And not only that, you certainly shouldn't be making kiddush on it. And it's worse than all fruit juices. He ain't bazeh, he she seed, al ha'humad amr, shezemitzah min ha'mukhar, l'kadeshua, that which Rabbi Horowitz is criticizing Rabbi Ginsburg for saying that you shouldn't say kiddush on it. Bazeh v'adayat tzedek imo, I agree with him. Demi hu zeh, because who is this Rabbi Ginsburg? Sheyatzah neged ha'magid avram, shepasak diyayim, Yashan, because why should I listen to Rabbi Ginsburg when the great Magen Avraham, who's printed for heavens on the page of the Shulchan Aruch, he says that it's a mitzvah nevuchar to use regular wine. Aval, mashahu seif, de'ein mevarech al zeh bari priyagafen. However, when he says that you shouldn't even make a bari priyagafen on grape juice, ve'ein mekanshinov, and you're not allowed to make kiddush on it at all, that l'chor he frees al hamidah. There he oversteps his bounds. Sheharei, the Shulchan Aruch he priya keharosh, so Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, I presume, was a great disappointment to Rabbi Horowitz. Didn't give him the answer that he was looking for. Okay, fine. That basically ends the story of Rabbi Ginsburg. He's attacked by the Orthodox rabbinate, although a very small-time rabbi, publishing long afterward in an obscure text. But nonetheless, that's the only record that I have of anybody criticizing Rabbi Ginsburg publicly. My hunch is that the reason why criticism of Rabbi Ginsburg did not happen more publicly by more prominent Orthodox rabbis is two things. Number one, they were reluctant to take him on because he was a bigger Talmud Chacham than they were. Mm. Remember, this is before all the great European rabbis like, you know, Rabbi Feinstein and Cutler and so on came to the United States. That's number one. Number two is that they were hoping that just by ignoring him, he would go away. And in a certain sense, it did. Now, if you read Yaakov Weinstein,
also they would be looked at as unpatriotic. And here they're saying you should drink wine, you should have it, it would be unpatriotic.
Could be, yes, could be. Now, there are three theories as to what was going on in the Orthodox community here and why the Orthodox rabbis were not more interested in embracing the idea of grape juice. One is, this is Hannah Sprecher's argument, which is that they were corrupt. They were making a lot of money off of this, and therefore they weren't interested in killing the goose that laid the golden egg. Second possibility is that they enjoyed the fact that their shul memberships were increasing, which makes some sense. A third possibility is that they were worried about what was next. In other words, a lot of people are suggesting that they were trying to stand up for their First Amendment rights. Because if they would give in and say we are willing to forego wine, then who knows, maybe shechita or mila is going to be the next thing that they're going to attack, and that's much more difficult to get around. So that's a possibility. I have another suggestion, which I still need to do some more work in order to prove, but it is the following. Their attitude was, why should we be more Catholic than the Pope? Meaning, the Catholics and all Christian denominations that use wine for communion were perfectly happy to enjoy this exemption, and nobody was attacking them as being un-American for doing so. Why should we Jews be any less than that? And I have a story that backs up this idea, which is particularly relevant to this shul, because for many years we had the pleasure of Rabbi Abraham Tversky speaking here between Mincha and Maariv occasionally. So Rabbi Tversky tells the following story. He told me this personally, which I didn't believe originally, but then I found it leads me to believe later on. Following story. Rabbi Tversky was in the alcoholic recovery business. And so he tells a story that once there was a Catholic priest who was an alcoholic who came to his hospital in Pittsburgh to be treated. And they treated him for a while, and he wasn't recovering. And they discovered that the reason why he wasn't recovering is because he was stealing cough medicine and drinking it, because cough medicine is alcohol-based. And so Tversky said, so I'm going to have to give you a drug that will cause you to vomit violently if you drink any alcohol at all. I think it's called Anitase, or I'm not sure. And the guy said, well, I can't do that, because if I'm on that drug, then I'll never be able to take communion, and without communion, I might as well kill myself, because I need communion. So Tversky said, I'll take care of it for you. This is in the 1980s. So Rabbi Tversky had connection, because of the alcoholic business, to a cardinal who had made Aliyah from the United States to Rome. And and this cardinal and Rabbi Tversky were still in touch, and so Rabbi Tversky writes a suggestion to this cardinal to bring to the Pope that since communion is, after all, a reenactment of the Pesach Seder, because the Last Supper is a Pesach Seder, and Jews today, based on Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva, permit the consumption of grape juice for dalet kosot, for people who have trouble tolerating wine. Therefore, the Christians, you know, it's like us. It's Ol Algam Mizbeach B'di'evet, so therefore they should be willing to use it for communion l'chatchila. So indeed, the Pope accepted this argument. And the Pope asked this cardinal to write a letter back to Rabbi Tversky, and Rabbi Tversky receives the letter, and it says that indeed this particular Catholic priest is permitted to drink grape juice for communion, and therefore he can take this drug, and he'll be, you know, on the road to recovery. And Rabbi Tversky writes back to the cardinal and says, please tell the Pope he did a mitzvah. Okay, great. So I didn't believe the story 100% until this past Sunday. So if you look at the picture that I have on the bottom here, this picture I took this past Sunday, my wife and I like to go bike riding along the Jersey Shore, and the town of Ocean Grove on the Jersey Shore is very front. They're very serious Methodists there. And the Methodists on Sunday morning hang out on the boardwalk encouraging people who are jogging by to take communion. And my wife says to me, look at that table.
And put on tefillin, or no?
No, that's not it. So the Methodists have this communion table out there with these, you know, large chalices of wine. But it isn't wine. She looks at it. Look at the... It was Kedem grape juice. And not only that, but it was Manischewitz matzah that they're using for their communion. So Rabbi Tversky really had this tremendous wide effect.
Left over from Pesach.
Yeah. So anyway, so that I think is the real reason. The real reason was that the Jews felt that there was no reason why we needed to be firmer than the Pope. If the Christians were willing at that time, it's sort of ironic now in the verse that now we accept grape juice, so they do also. But the point that the rabbis at that time were making was, why should we have to forego something that is important to us, even if grape juice is acceptable, even if it's okay? Nonetheless, now there's two more side points I want to make to this, and then I'm done. One is Yaakov Weinstein makes an important point, which is that because of Rabbi Horowitz's tshuva, and because of the political reality that Orthodox Jews wanted to distinguish themselves from conservatives, for about 30 years, from the mid-20s until the mid-1950s, Jews, number one, typically made shehakol on grape juice, and number two, drank Welch's grape juice without a hechsher, without any concern about yain, you know, stam yainam, for many, many, many years, based on this assumption that it wasn't wine. And only in the 1950s did somebody write a shaila to Rav Henkin and say, I don't understand, why shouldn't we be concerned about stam yainam for this? Doesn't grape juice need a hechsher? And then everything turned around. So that, you can read Yaakov Weinstein's very
interesting. I grew up in a house where we looked at grape juice.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, there you go. It was very common in the 40s and 50s to, you know, if you're invited to somebody's house for Shabbos lunch and they're making Kiddush, the Orthodox people used wine and the conservative people used grape juice. That's one point. Second point is that a part of this that I think needs to be investigated further is whether Orthodox Jews were even reading the New York Times. I suspect that they were not. And therefore, all of the scandals that were exposed by the New York Times about corruption in the kosher wine industry were of very little relevance to Orthodox Jews. Most Orthodox Jews were either themselves immigrants and spoke only Yiddish, or were second-generation Americans and spoke mostly Yiddish. And what was written in the New York Times, which was for, you know, waspy New Yorkers, was really not of interest to them. And the notion that there was this Chil Hashem being created by all the scandals that were exposed by the New York Times was probably not even on their radar. And that's why, or let me contribute to the reasons, why the Orthodox community in the 1920s didn't even address it, because they didn't feel as though addressing it would solve any problems more than it would cause.
Yeah, and just what's the story of the end of the prohibition? When did it end?
1933. It passed the 21st Amendment.
And that you repealed the 18th Amendment.
The whole thing.
Right.
Prohibition is the only amendment in the history of the United States to be completely undergone.
So that represents a huge shift, right? You know, it takes 3 years to get an amendment passed.
Well, it can happen quickly, but yeah.
Right, but so what was the what happened to the nationalism movement? That how did it just turn?
It didn't change. None of that changed. What changed was that it was seen as being impractical,
right. Just unenforceable.
Correct. I mean, a great movie, the Elliot Ness movie, The Untouchables, with what's his name, that Kevin Costner.
Ness.
Wonderful movie. Wonderful movie. It gives you everything you need to know about prohibition. It wasn't that anybody was arguing at the end of Prohibition that intoxicating liquors were really okay. That wasn't it at all. It was that it was turning people against the government. It was people were going to do it anyway, therefore you might as well make it legal. Similar to the argument about marijuana today.
So like Engels and Zerich and Sibir.
Yeah, correct.
And was the issues of corruption, were they broader than just the Orthodox movement?
Oh, yeah.
It must have been a
not.
The Orthodox Jewish... The Jewish... Right, exactly. Speakeasies, bootlegging, all of that, yeah.
I mean, somebody must have realized when they put prohibition in that they were going to make organized crime a lot of money.
I don't think it was well thought out in advance. I don't think so. I think that as it became evident, then people started to realize that it had been a bad idea.
Question. Did the Catholic Church avoid this whole corruption issue? Did they also not face the
It
challenge?
It was not completely uncorrupt, but it was much less prone to corruption because of the fact that the volume of wine being given out at communion is very small, and it's highly supervised, and it's in the church. You have to go to the church to get it.
Marshall was one of the founders of the American Jewish Committee.
Ah, okay, thank you. Yes. Okay.
Would it be inception to argue that Orthodox Jews didn't read the New York Times, because probably was being published at least in the secular Yiddish press as well.
Right, right, right,
so
correct.
You have to argue also that they didn't read the secular Yiddish press at that time. Also, no?
Correct. Yeah, so I don't know. I don't know. Or it may just be that the fact that they knew about it as something to be written in the New York Times and discussed by WASPI New Yorkers didn't bother them. Jews were used to...
I don't know, but I can't imagine that it was ignored by the secular Jewish press. So they have to also say, you know, this is non-from
correct.
Jews that you...
Right, so this is something for your wife to research for us.
You don't do that. But it's more American history.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. I have a question, Martin. Great Jews, the rabbis of Israel, not writing this on a beat. Why great Jews?
It's very common in Shuva literature for them to use whatever the term is that the person writing to them taught them, even though it's not Hebrew. You find that in Rav Moshe Feinstein's Shuva all the time.
All over.
But I was used in America, the other guy used it.
Yeah, but
that's why I wondered why it's not Hebrew.
I think it was.
He says it is.